Okay, this is May. There was an article by a writer. He wrote one book, looking out for number one, Dr. Wayne Dwyer. He has a new book, The Sky's the Limit. I like what he writes, and I like to hear him on KGO Radio, the talk shows, and see the comments he has, because Dwyer always talks about people not using their abilities to achieve things that they should be doing in the world or to find much out of life that has meaning. And there was an article just this last week, a resume of his feelings about depression, and the article is called "Don't Let the Headlines Get You Down." And there's headlines about the stock plunging and nuclear mishaps, and 24 reported slain, 300 raid on the U.S. embassy. He's got a list of murder plots and things, and asked, "Are you depressed?" And his answer, for people, oversimplified, but he covers it a lot in his book, is that the only reason people are depressed when they see headlines and the news media is that they feel helpless and that they're not willing to aspire. He says most people are victimized not because they fail to achieve, but because they fail to aspire. They lack the courage to take on institutions, he said, and they're afraid of big guys, that they can't face the government. They say the government is too big, and they'll complain about the Middle East or crime. And he says the minute you give up in the solution, give up thinking about the solution, it only gets worse. It never gets better. And if you allow yourself to become part of the problem, you never can find the solution. And he suggested things that I've suggested many times, write letters to your representatives, write letters to companies, picket companies or organizations that are destroying the environment, have discussion groups, take positive action with friends or other people, and don't feel like the system has licked you, because if you feel it's too big and you get pessimistic and you don't take action, you lose something. And if you take action, you have a feeling that you at least have a part in being constructive. And sometimes constructive people do set the way and others follow. There's a man that passed away this last week. His name was Louis Lundberg, and he was vice president of the Bank of America. And the article over his obituary in the newspaper said, "Banker kept his candor in the establishment world." And it tells how he testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1970 and denounced the Vietnam War, and at the time they thought it was like treason. And he said that it was wrong. The capitalistic democracy had to have moral integrity. And they had a quotation, "No more powerful and sweeping denunciation of this nation's Vietnamese degradation is likely to ever be voiced." He was 74 when he retired from the Bank of America. He opposed the war, and we're still paying the debts to this immoral, terrible war. And I'm sure that one person alone like Lundberg doesn't make a difference, or the youth out on the street protesting. But when you get men such as a Lundberg, who's the vice president of the Bank of America, arguing with Mr. Giannini over certain loyalty oath issues way back in 1949 and taking stands to preserve what he wants in a democracy, when you get people like that standing up, it does influence a certain position of people in Congress to not turn Vietnam into a parking lot and not to use the atomic bombs there. So that there are people in the establishment speaking up, and it's so unusual for them to do it that they even made a note over his obituary saying that he had candor in an establishment world. I know it can be done, and the thing that Dwyer writes about is enough people who know what's going on aren't taking a position to stop the terrible, horrendous acts that are being perpetuated by our government. We don't have to watch other governments, as I say, but we should watch our own. There were getting now to three television shows this week that were interesting. I don't usually cover television programs on KLRB, but there were three this week that were interesting. One was called The Bunker, a three-hour program put on by CBS. Then there was one on mind control and the control of a fellow who was in the military, James Thornwell, who was given LSD by the Army, and it tells about his crazy desire to die and how terrible it was to be given what the Army had called EA-1729, which is LSD, how he begged to be killed and wanted to die. And many people who do get LSD are suicidal. We hear about certain rock musicians committing suicide. I'm sure that they were administered this product manufactured by the Army. And then there was a program on the Broder Band. That's a very strong cult in South Africa that was formed right after World War I in 1919. Their strength became much bigger, and they combined with Adolf Hitler, and they're a violently anti-black organization that runs South Africa and their apartheid policies. And there was a interview with a man who keeps the blacks in their place down there, as he said, and they asked him, don't you think you go too far? And he said, no, the blacks have to learn to walk first. He says, you can't run before you walk. And while they're human beings and they breathe like me, they just haven't started walking yet, so they can't run to progress. The Bunker was the most terrible movie I've seen in favor of Nazi Germany. I felt it was very pro-Adolf Hitler. It was sponsored, if you look at the credits, by Time Life. The Henry Luce Organization put it on. And then at the movie, they have books to read, one by Mr. Toland on Adolf Hitler, and the other, U. Trevor Roper's Last Days of Hitler. And I have very strong feelings about the possibility that Hitler escaped from the Bunker. I think the Goebbels family did, in fact, die. But this movie was very pro-Hitler, and they gave speeches of Hitler, and you could almost see them recruiting for the next generation. It was filled with disinformation. At the end, they said Martin Bormann died, and it's a pretty well-known fact that Martin Bormann is still alive today. As I say, the mind control program was exactly as it happened, and the fellow who was given the LSD got a settlement from the government. They paid him money, the largest settlement they've ever given, $625,000, and he was interviewed on the radio and said that's exactly the way it happened. And really the motive for singling him out was that he was attracted to a white woman in the GI Club in France, and they said black men don't mix with white women. So they used the excuse that some documents were missing and tortured him and experimented on drugs that have kept him sick and unable to hold a family or a job to this day. And finally, with attorneys through the Freedom of Information Act, they found out about his torture. The Broder Band brought in certain scandals of the government and the use of their secret money to barely hint at buying off newspapers that praised the South African government, the propaganda to make them palatable and acceptable to the Western world. But these were interesting programs, all interrelated, the Adolf Hitler story and the mind control story and the South African, because very many people in the news today go from South Africa to London and Germany and to California and to the headquarters where a lot of this drug smuggling, gun running, racism, funding of fascism is taking place. There was a death last week. I got an article, again, from the same listener who got the Cromer story for me up in the San Francisco Examiner, a story about an attorney passing away just last week, Robert Story. He was an attorney who was selected by the Texas officials to investigate the murder of John Kennedy. Robert Story died this last week in Texas. The interesting thing about the obituary was it tells how he was not a lawyer in his life. He never was a lawyer, but he became head of the American Bar Association. He was one of the people that went to Nuremberg to, in quotes, try the Nazis, along with Leon Jaworski, who later was recognized as part of the Anderson CIA Foundation. And he went to the Middle East and South Africa again and Southeast Asia. And Story has been a powerful State Department official and a dean of law without ever going to law school in Texas. Edward Epstein described in the book Inquest how after John Kennedy was killed, a conference was set out with the White House, the Texas Attorney General Wagner Carr announced they would have a court of inquiry. And these two men, Leon Jaworski of the CIA and Robert G. Story, were special counsel. They were supposed to be special counsel for this investigation. And in this book, Inquest, Epstein describes two prominent Texas lawyers. Well, it turns out that one of the two was never a lawyer and never graduated from law school, so that the two people assigned to investigate John Kennedy's murder in Texas were Leon Jaworski of the CIA and Robert Story of the State Department International, a man with government Pentagon links all over the world. Now, as soon as Kennedy was killed, many people yelled conspiracy. They suspected when Lee Harvey Oswald was murdered that this inquiry to begin on the 25th of November was not sufficient, so that on November 29th, Lyndon Johnson appointed a commission to investigate the murder of John Kennedy that became known as the Warren Commission. And, of course, he had Leon Jaworski as an advisor from the CIA, and then he put Alan Dulles, the former director of the CIA, and Richard Russell, the watchdog of the CIA, and John J. McCloy, whose office wrote false papers for agents of the CIA and chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank. And the entire Warren Commission was stacked, Gerald Ford from Navy Intelligence and CIA, and these handpicked people of Earl Warren's continued covering up the lie of who killed John Kennedy. But it's interesting that Robert Story died this week. There wasn't anything in any paper that I noticed about his death, except for the clipping I got from the San Francisco Examiner. Maybe you have some notices, but I don't have those around. Now, to get to a trial that's going on, because I won't be able to cover a lot of the material I brought in, but we'll do as much as we can. There's a trial going on in New York City of Jean Harris. She's the schoolmistress who killed Dr. Tonauer, the famous Scarsdale diet doctor. And those of you who have my tapes or those who want them, I did broadcast about Jean Harris on March 28th last year. That was just a year ago, 1980, tape 434 and 435. With the links of Mrs. Harris, she was in the Soviet Union a year before Lee Harvey Oswald went there as an agent of the CIA. She worked for Allied Maintenance, owned by Gulf and Western, from 1975 to 77. And that was a janitorial service. And then took a job at McLean University, Virginia, not a university, a Madera school, a girls' school, where she led what they called a private life. And I did tapes on the Philadelphia connections the time Dr. Tonauer was murdered. Angelo Bruner of organized crime in Philadelphia, her home base was murdered, and Abscam was breaking. And I felt there were links of them to an international narcotics, again, a high-level narcotics CIA combine, and that Tonauer was wiped out, and this woman was a woman of mystery. And she's been going to this trial, and her defense is that he had so many different women that she had to shoot him. He was sleeping with all of these women. But one article in the New York Times gave a clue to what I was aiming at in the past and watching about the background of this Jean Harris. It's an article January 26, just last week, and it describes Mrs. Harris as headmistress for this school in McLean, Virginia, and it goes into her prescriptions. The druggist, the pharmacist, Joseph Eisenberg, was testifying last week about her. She had 10 prescriptions. She had Desoxin, which was a stimulant, and Percobarb, a sedative, and Percodan, a painkiller, and Plexanol, a depressant, and Valium, a tranquilizer, and Nebutol, sleeping pills. And she was known at the school as somebody who expelled girls who had drugs. This woman was very strict on children, any kind of drugs, and yet she had a whole walking who's who of medications, it seems. But one interesting point about her trial is that her son was testifying at the trial, James Harris, and he's in the Marines now, and he went to her home, and two vials of medication had been delivered to her house the day after the shooting. Evidently, she didn't realize this delivery was coming, and drugs must have been shipped to her from the pharmacy up in Westchester, White Plains, New York. So she had gone up to shoot Dr. Tonauer, and I compared her to Candy Jones, that she was under mind control and was hypnotized and was used by the CIA and had this double personality, the schoolmistress plus the international traveler with this mysterious, well-funded Dr. Tonauer. And right after she was arrested the next day, some more drugs came to her at the Madera school, and her son, who's in the Marines, testified that they found empty medication vials in her medicine cabinet, but they were also prescribed for a person whose name he didn't recognize. Now, an important part of putting together the pieces that I did last March and April on Mrs. Harris and the killing of Dr. Tonauer with the possible links to the whole abscam, Angela Bruner, this system coming unglued of drugs, trips to Russia, trips to Europe. She would go to Paris with him. Lots of money, mysterious connections. The who here is what we have to find out. Whose name was were the drugs being sent to? Because just the week before this happened, Alan Lowenstein was murdered in New York City, and he was murdered by a man who was under mind control, such as Mark David Chapman, who killed John Lennon. This man's name was Dennis Sweeney. And March 21st, a year ago, I was asking questions about the man who murdered Alan Lowenstein, the former congressman and the right-hand man of Ted Kennedy at the time the elections were coming up, because Sweeney was married to Mary Byrne. That was the chief of Jimmy Carter's drug narcotics group in the White House. That was his first wife, and Sweeney had undergone mind control and, again, had been sent to Europe and mental hospitals. And so I have to ask the question for you readers and listeners who save these articles. Was she administering in the Washington area in McLean, Virginia, prescriptions that were coming out of White Plains, New York, that were shipped from the pharmacy to her? And whose name was there that they didn't recognize? Certainly they weren't students in the school. And this woman lived a double life and worked for a mob group at Madison Square Garden that were linked to the highest echelons of American business, that have also been involved with narcotics and Bolivian cocaine. I did a thing several weeks on that. I don't want to jump around too much, but these stories are coming together, little pieces, and I have done many tapes and broadcasts on Jean Harris and Tannauer. So when we find out who the medications were going to while she was the headmistress at McLean, Virginia, I think we're going to find high up ranks that go way in back to London with her Philadelphia friends such as Cummings or Monaco, and the international drug, the headquarters in Paris and London, and the trip she took to Africa with Tannauer. I think they were into a lot more, and that she was like Candy Jones and was controlled and could go up there and shoot him with four bullets and say she wanted to die. There's another program, a lot of programs I did on Michael Sindona, a man that was the financier for the Vatican who met with Pope Paul VI when he was Montini and began investing Vatican money into organized crime. And I did many broadcasts on Sindona and how he escaped from his jail and went to Europe last year. And for those of you who want the link of the Vatican to the Gambino family and organized crime, you can write, and I'll give you the dates of those tapes. Those go back to November 1979, November and March of 1980. I was talking about Sindona. In March, I did a program on Sindona, alias J-B-O-N-A-M-I-C-O, Bonamico, who flew to Vienna, Munich, and Germany when he was arrested by the New York Police Department for taking this $45 million from the Franklin Bank. He went to Frankfurt again, Frankfurt, Germany, and then came back to New York, and he had invested Vatican money with links to the Carlo Gambino family. Now, this week there was an article, "To Fight Vatican Deficit." Pope John Paul II has called in economic experts because the Vatican is $19 million in deficit for the first time in 2 years. Now, the Vatican money is tied in to organized crime, and it's being strangled. Just as Richard Nixon's administration was cutting off the Italian mafia, there's an interconnecting web between the Italian-Irish mafia fighting, and the Vatican money was put into organized crime, if you can believe such a thing. Well, last week you may have read in the newspapers about a jailbreak attempt in New York City. An armed man and woman hijacked a helicopter from New Jersey and went after allegedly a convicted narcotics dealer, a known murderer, and they tried to land on the 12th story of the Metropolitan Correction Center in New York City. Funny enough, they couldn't get through because the wire was too heavy and they couldn't cut through the heavy wire. But up on the roof with this known murderer and one of the largest dealers of narcotics in New Jersey is none other than Michael Sindona himself, the financier for the Vatican, who was paying Nixon and Murray Stans and helped invest in the Watergate Hotel when it was built. The Vatican owned that. Up on the rooftop is none other than Michael Sindona, one of the inmates who the San Jose Mercury described as the Italian financier with Robert Weiler, the 43-year-old recently convicted narcotics dealer. They thought Weiler was the target of the raid, and there was a three-hour siege. And Sedona, the article goes on, it says, Sedona, the Italian financier, was convicted last year in a multi-million-dollar international banking fraud, was among the people on the roof, but they believe the actual target was Weiler of Manhattan, who was recently sentenced to 20 years. Weiler has been known for narcotics charges and murder, the murder of a pimp over his 14-year-old prostitute. He's a member of the mafia, and the helicopter was taken by a Miss Sanchez out of New Jersey and arranged to with a Vietnam veteran from New Jersey to help fly these people. They had a lot of cash, paid $1,600 for the helicopter and so forth. So the article doesn't go into the background of Sedona. It says that they were going for the murderer and the narcotic dealer. But the interesting story, of course, is that he did escape once and went to Europe and came back. And here he's on the roof to escape again. And what I call a laugh a minute, I did several weeks ago, it really is a comic situation or a tragic situation that, as I say, since World War II, since Lucky Luciano heavily embedded with the CIA and he had helped put Mussolini into power, and this element got the bankers of the Vatican to invest and mingle, if they didn't do it before, and I don't know how much they did before, after World War II, they invested into operations, and when one group of the crime syndicate, I call them the Irish mob, want to wipe out the Italian mob, they tangled the Vatican with them so that this John Paul II is strangled, and they own a lot of property. The Vatican isn't poor. They own a lot of church land, and they could begin selling their property, the $19 million deficit. They could just sell their church on Wilshire Boulevard, and that would pay the deficit. But the problem is that they're caught in that web that I described the first half hour of this program, that even the churches and the presidents, and what is happening now is the financiers and bankers are getting insecure, and the system is falling apart. This missing money isn't going to hold up, and I wonder how long it can go before there's an end to this kind of conspiracy that webs all these various forces together. Next week, I want to do at length, begin, because I'll just have a few minutes now, a story that came out of the San Francisco Chronicle last week, January the 11th, with a headline story, the CIA is linked to a curious case, the mystery of a disappearing actress, the CIA. Now, this case involves a woman, Valerie McDonald, who hasn't been seen since November the 9th. It involves a murder of one of the men who allegedly abducted her by the Royal Canadian Police in British Columbia. And it involves various countries and a prison guard who was buying weapons for gun running in El Salvador to put the right wing in power, who worked with three prison guards in San Francisco. And one of them, the prison guard, rather, was getting the weapons for three former prisoners that were just released out of San Quentin. One of them was killed by the Royal Canadian Police. The other gentleman is released. His name is John Abbott. His father represents the United Nations over in Rome. His mother's a professor at Davis. He's being held by the Canadian police. A Philip Thompson, who was an apartment manager who just got out of San Quentin, and a Michael Hennessy, who was murdered by the Canadian police. Now, a prison guard was out buying the guns and weapons, sending them to El Salvador. It involves the Hibernia Bank in San Francisco, where millions of dollars could be missing. This John Abbott, the son of the fellow who works for the United Nations in Rome, again in Rome, Italy, whose mother's a professor, started collecting stolen art goods and art objects and was caught with $250,000 of stolen property, a cache of automatic weapons. This is a story of people with cement and rope and hotels, brilliant IQs. It's a story that headlines the CIA linked to the death of an actress. And as the story unraveled since January the 11th, it involves, as I say, the right-wing fascist group in El Salvador, a prison guard who resigned from San Quentin, who worked with three former prisoners. Three people have been murdered that are linked to this case so far, and the murders, I'm sure, will escalate. and international travel. The woman from Germany, from Canada, New Mexico to California. And again, it involved guns, heroin, millions of dollars, credit cards, a prison guard, former prisoners, international connections, all to fund, if they would send guns down to El Salvador for the right wing to put down the people's movement, they could in return get cocaine, and $1 million worth of cocaine would bring them $11 million in this country. So what I'm talking about is right-wing counterinsurgency, definitely linked the first time by the headlines to the CIA. Now, all of these things later get linked to the CIA or the Drug Enforcement Agency, but this right from the word go said CIA linked. And that's why I think the system is getting unglued when top people with inside knowledge of the Hibernia Bank can squeeze it out of millions of dollars that is put into guns that go to South America. In return, they bring cocaine and narcotics to this country so that in exchange for those guns down there, millions are taken out of banks knowingly. In the United States, millions of dollars are put into weapons. The weapons are sent to Nazi right-wing groups all over the world, Bolivia, Colombia, Argentina, Chile, El Salvador, Honduras, Dominican Republic, Libya, Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, Turkey. We send them guns. They send back the narcotics. The narcotics bring a profit of 10 to 1, and with that money, we buy more guns, and the banks, in the meanwhile, have to explain where these missing millions are going. And the federal agencies, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the CIA agency, the FBI are involved in these things, the police, and so forth. So the economy, I don't think, can take this kind of treatment much longer. The banks can't take it. And I'll be doing more on this next week because you just see a simple article in Wells Fargo and Beverly Hills this week. Bank probing apparent loss to embezzler. One embezzler, several million dollars. This was January the 30th, 2 days ago. And then it says, appears to be an internal job. It may be up to $20 million gone. How many banks can face that kind of millions, and how many around the country are doing it? And these fascist governments are run by a bunch of hoodlums so that the educated, knowing people who are being pushed aside have to have some counter-reaction. So this buildup from World War II of using organized crime, gun running, and narcotics seems to be coming apart at the seams. If you take a map and mark the cities, it's astronomical, the figures and the implications. And how far it'll go, I don't know. And how much they're arming private police like the Nazis or the Minutemen and the Klan, that we don't know. That murder that's involved with that Cromer girl in Oakland talks about, he is responsible for security of atomic bombs. Imagine a man who kills over 4,000 people, he says, for two presidents who's in charge of transporting atomic bombs. That is the crazy world we're living with. Well, we've got a little while to think about it. I'll be back with you next week on KLRB. It's pretty startling, but we have to watch it because it is happening, and these headlines are coming out every single day. Different cities, different names, but the same kind of operation. This is Mae Bressel. I'll be back with you next week, and you take care.
This has been World Watchers International with noted conspiracy investigator Mae Bressel. This program originates from Carmel, California.